young people unaccompanied in the shelters are in highly vulnerable circumstances. GLBTQ youth are highly vulnerable out on the streets. They're coming from a background of rejection, family rejection, rejection by their peers. Many are coming out of small towns, completely alienated and lost once they show up in the big city.
The Two-Spirit tradition has been a part of many Native American cultures in North America for thousands of years. This idea that there is a variety of gender and sexual orientation, and that it's just a part of how people are made.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. ACT lawmakers hope their third civil unions try will be the charm. Homeless queer youth seek salvation, and the life and death of a Two-Spirit teen. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Santina Giordano.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 14th, 2009. Legislators in the Australian Capital Territory, which includes the city of Canberra, this week passed a law to allow same-gender civil unions that include official ceremonies. But the measure, spearheaded by the Green Party, puts the territory on a collision course with the federal government, which can overrule territorial laws. The Labor government of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, like the previous Liberal government of John Howard, opposes civil union ceremonies for lesbian and gay couples because it believes they're too much like weddings and violate Australian law that defines marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Legislation opening civil marriage to same-gender couples in the territory was repealed after federal intervention in 2006, and ACT lawmakers backed down in 2008 after the federal government signaled its intention to overturn proposed civil unions for lesbian and gay couples that included legal ceremonies. They then approved a civil partnerships law without an official ceremony. Territorial attorneys are now arguing that same-gender civil unions are exempt from federal jurisdiction. ACT Attorney General Simon Corbell told reporters that unless they are able to come up with an argument that says why this impinges on constitutional powers available to them, and they haven't been able to do that to date, I simply have to conclude that federal opposition is a form of discrimination. It's a form of bigotry.
A judge in Buenos Aires ruled this week that a same-gender couple should be allowed to get married. If the ruling stands, Alex Freire and Jose Maria Di Bello could become the first same-gender couple to legally marry in Argentina or in any other South American country. Administrative Judge Gabriela Cejas said that denying a marriage license to the couple violated legal protections against gender discrimination. The law should treat everyone with the same respect according to their singularities, she wrote, without the need to understand or regulate them. Buenos Aires was the first city in the region to establish civil unions for same-gender couples in 2002, and its government could have challenged the court ruling, but Mayor Mauricio Macri said he approved of the decision. This is an important step, his statement read, because we must learn how to live in freedom without hurting the rights of others. There have been no reports about other possible appeals of the ruling, which is valid only in Buenos Aires. Federal marriage equality legislation is currently stalled in Argentina's lower house of Congress.
According to Eastern France, has granted a lesbian the right to adopt a child. The woman, identified only as Emmanuel B., fought an 11-year-long legal battle over the issue. The European Court of Human Rights ruled in favor of Emmanuel B. in 2008 and ordered France to pay her court costs and damages. But the court had no power to force France to grant her adoption rights, even though single people can adopt there, and her application continued to be rejected. The court in Besançon this week ordered local authorities in the Jura mountain region where she lives to extend adoption rights to the 48-year-old schoolteacher within 15 days or face a daily fine thereafter. Because it was a closely watched case, and even though she filed an adoption request as an individual, the court knew that Emmanuel B. is also in a long-term lesbian relationship. Her partner as a child psychologist. The French government immediately reiterated its opposition to adoption by same-gender couples. In overturning the rejection of Emmanuel B's adoption application, the court wrote that the parental, educational, and psychological conditions provided by the applicant are in line with the needs and interest of the adopted child.
In other news, the Church of Sweden this week consecrated its first openly lesbian or gay bishop. 55-year-old Eva Brun became Bishop of Stockholm, Sweden's capital, in a ceremony in nearby Uppsala. She's in a same-gender civil partnership, and they have a 3-year-old child. The Church of Sweden, which is Lutheran, supported the nation's marriage equality legislation, which took effect on May 1st and replaced the inferior civil partnership law. The church claims about 3 in 4 Swedes and previously blessed civil partnerships. It began allowing its priests to conduct same-gender wedding ceremonies on November 1st.
But the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. says passage of a proposed marriage equality law there would force it to end its social service programs for the city. The church claims that the marriage measure would require it to comply with existing laws prohibiting discrimination against LGBT people. While religious groups would not be required to perform or accommodate same-gender wedding ceremonies under the new law, the Washington Post reported this week that church officials said they were fearful that they could be forced, among other things, to extend employee benefits to same-sex married couples, and that they would have no choice but to abandon their contracts with the city. The church's social services agency, Catholic Charities, provides homeless services and health care for tens of thousands of D.C. residents. The city council is, by all accounts, undeterred by the church's apparent threats, and near unanimous passage of the marriage equality legislation is expected in early December. The U.S. Congress has oversight of all district laws, however. It remains to be seen if there will be a challenge there to a D.C. marriage law.
Elsewhere, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known as the Mormons, was reportedly instrumental in the unanimous passage this week in Salt Lake City, Utah, of anti-discrimination protections for LGBT people. The 2-city ordinances ban employment and housing discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. They'll take effect in April. Each bill has an exemption for religious organizations and their affiliates. The church supports these ordinances because they are fair and reasonable, LDS spokesman Michael Otterson said after the vote, and they do not do violence to the institution of marriage. Mormon elder Jeffrey R. Holland told the Salt Lake Tribune that anything good is shareable and that his city's legislation could be a model for the entire state. The church's endorsement stunned many in Utah's LGBT community, some of whom, according to the Tribune, called it historic. Will Carlson, director of public policy for the advocacy group Equality Utah, told the paper that this is a great step, but noted that 4 out of 5 LGBT people in Utah live outside the capital and should also have the same protections.
Updating a story we reported a few weeks ago, the shows will indeed go on. A Nevada judge has ruled that a high school theater class should not be blocked from performing The Laramie Project and the musical Rent. A group known as Concerned Parents of Green Valley High in the city of Henderson, near Las Vegas, filed a lawsuit in October complaining about the play's drugs-related content and gay characters. Clark County District Court Judge David Wall ruled this week that since participation in and attendance at the plays was voluntary, he saw no legal reason to stop them. Performances of The Laramie Project, which chronicles the 1998 slaying of gay college student Matthew Shepard and its aftermath, began this weekend. Rent, School Edition, an edited version of the musical omitting certain expletives and one sexually explicit song, will be staged early next year.
And finally, a 10-year-old boy in Arkansas has refused to pledge allegiance to the flag until gays and lesbians have equal rights in the country for which it stands. Will Phillips, a 5th grader in the West Fork School District in Washington County, decided to remain seated last month while other children in his class stood to recite the traditional pledge. After the teacher berated him several days in a row for refusing to stand, Will told the Arkansas Times that he finally lost patience with her, saying, "With all due respect, ma'am, you can go jump off a bridge." And that led to a visit with the school principal, who called his mother Laura. She said it was Will's legal right not to stand. The principal acknowledged that right, affirmed by a 1943 U.S. Supreme Court ruling, and Will reportedly hasn't stood since. His defiance has brought national attention, along with taunts, but also admiration, from other kids at his school. Will has attended LGBT Pride events with his mother and father, and the family has gay friends. Mrs. Phillips told The Times that her son is probably more aware of the meaning of the pledge than a lot of adults. He's not just doing it rote recitation. We raised him to be aware of what's right, what's wrong, and what's fair. Will told the newspaper that he hoped to be a lawyer one day, and that contrary to the words of the pledge, I really don't feel that there's currently liberty and justice for all.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 14th, 2009, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Santina Giordano.
And I'm Rick Watts.
Several Native American tribes traditionally honored the special societal role of gender-variant people. Our Steve Pride previews a new film about that and more later in the program. Homeless LGBT youth all too often fall through the cracks of traditional social service programs. In the first of a special two-part feature, This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend explore how Minnesota is finding solutions to a seriously shameful situation, starting with State Senator Scott Dibble.
Thank you for being here, Senator Dibble.
Thanks so much, Dixie. John?
Thank you. It's great to have you here. Tell us a little bit about what has drawn you to this issue.
Well, I first got involved in the issue of dealing with, confronting, trying to respond to the issue of homeless youth a number of years ago. Been, of course, involved in the GLBT community in a variety of capacities, going back to the 80s, mostly working on HIV/AIDS issues. And a few years ago, a few folks from the community decided to get together and really respond to this issue of homeless and at-risk youth. And we started a community conversation. The result of that, of course, was the GLBT Youth Host Home Program. Following that, I joined Youth Link. It was then the Minneapolis Youth Diversion Program, Project Off Streets. Served as a board member there for a number of years. Came to the legislature. Happy to say that the legislature is now confronting this issue, establishing a firm foundation of policy. And these issues that young people confront, these are young people from 12 on up to 21 who are unaccompanied, who have a unique set of challenges. Many of them have been a part of the foster system and have either aged out or that system has not served them well. So we're starting an important conversation and an important effort. We've got a long ways to go.
A policy being created around reusing buildings that are no longer used but could be used for people who are homeless or in transition.
Well, I think that's a great idea. That's come up a number of times, certainly at the municipal level. We haven't really had a big conversation around that at the state level, though I do know that there are, you know, some funds, though we're, of course, challenged. We need not be as challenged as we are, is the short version.
There are the unique challenges of youth who are GLBTQ intersexed.
Well, certainly I think we can safely say through the research and the studies that we need a lot more good data and good information, but there's been some good work done by Wilder Research. There's been some good work done through the Department of Health and others that tell us that GLBTQ young people are overrepresented. That probably isn't a surprise, but it's important to have the data, have the figures, and to understand qualitatively what are their lives like, what led them to this particular circumstance, and that gives us a roadmap to the kind of services, the kind of interventions that they need. There's also a study that's been turned in by the Department of Health that identifies that continuum of services that was then translated into a very important policy document that we adopted a couple of years ago, the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. Young people unaccompanied in the shelters are in highly vulnerable circumstances. GLBTQ youth are highly vulnerable out on the streets. They're coming from a background of rejection, family rejection, rejection by their peers. Many are coming out of small towns, completely alienated and lost once they show up in the big city.
Are there any programs in schools for youth who are homeless?
We have a specific program to make sure young homeless people can continue attending the same school, that they're getting some support services, help them with, for lack of a better term, process of emancipation, make sure that they're able to make decisions on their own behalf in the absence of interested adults in their lives.
Senator Dibble, you're dealing sometimes with children as young as 12?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about 12, 13, you know, young people who absolutely don't have the resources and the tools they need to really get through life. But what I think people are more surprised by are the needs of young people who have, quote, aged out of the system. Once you're 18, boom, you're out. Well, who among us, once we turned 18, you know, we're fully capable adults? None of us. No, we continue to rely on parents or other folks to help us with major life decisions, support, all kinds of things. To just simply turn people out and expect them to thrive, particularly those who are starting so much further behind in many circumstances with a lot of emotional needs, chemical dependency issues, mental health issues. So really addressing these folks who are 18 to 21, 22 and making sure that they continue to receive adequate and sufficient services is also a big challenge. You know, we have some of the greatest wealth, and to simply turn people out and turn our backs on them is absolutely unacceptable. So I hope as we move into the legislative session come February, people really will raise their voices, march in the governor's office, pressure the legislature, and make sure we do what's right.
Kirsten Anderson and Nicole Mills work with Lutheran Social Services.
Tell us about what Lutheran Social Services does regarding GLBT homeless youth.
Our director, Susan Phillips, is a staunch advocate for GLBT youth. Just recently did a training with Alex Nilsson around transgender youth within the homeless youth communities at large. She was part of the transgender youth summits that happened a few years ago, speaking towards how to make shelters friendly for transgender youth in particular, but for all GLBT youth. We do a good job of trainings with staff and do other things like have safe zone markers around shelters and things that say this is a GLBT-friendly space and we have rainbows. Our focus is on climate for GLBT youth.
This is really a statewide issue. I think that we tend to think of homelessness that youth experience as an urban phenomenon, and we know that truly wherever there are young people, there are homeless young people. And that bears out in the data and the anecdotes and the lives lived. So LSS also has services for youth in a variety of other locations in Minnesota. And in those regions, we also see various experiences of youth homelessness and reach out to all populations and GLBT youth included.
Naturally, cities are magnets, particularly for GLBT youth.
Are there a lot of young people that are doing this?
Well, again, some general numbers on homeless youth. In the state of Minnesota, on any given night, there are 1,800 young people who don't have a place to stay. We are able to serve a very minor number of the young people who do experience homelessness on any given night. Our goal should be that we ultimately want to have a state where young people can be free to express themselves, and if they do find themselves coming out in an adverse situation, that there would be supportive adults in that community who they could turn to, because we know that the further a young person gets from their home, community of origin, the more vulnerable they appear and the more easily targeted they are by predators who are out there who want to seek their services for survival sex and other activities that the young person clearly did not wake up seeking that as an opportunity, but when survival is the question, they're easy targets.
I have to wonder about the conscience of a parent who would disown their child, a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, I don't care. How can one be so naive as a parent to think that they won't be susceptible to things like drug dealers and survival sex, as you say?
There's a lot of religious or cultural backgrounds that don't have any allowance for any diversity of gender expression or sexual orientation in any regard. A lot of young people also think when they come out, they know that homophobia exists in the world. They don't think their parents will be that homophobic person. So they come out and then all of a sudden they're shocked. Oh my, couldn't even imagine that my mom would be this homophobic person and kick me out of my house. There's a lot of stories of parent violence with young people when they come out to extreme measures that's shocking to me.
Do parents ever come to you?
When parents usually do come to us, it's generally when their children have severe persistent mental health issues. The public's awareness around GLBT homeless youth and to have the ability to provide more resources would be amazing.
In the conclusion of this special two-part feature, Dixie Trichel and John Townsend introduce us to a formerly homeless gay teen and the man who took him in.
I was approximately 18 years old and had found myself homeless. I didn't know anyone in Minnesota. I was originally from California. And so I didn't have any friends where I could couch hop, per se. So yeah, I was unfortunately literally on the streets at that time.
Next time on This Way Out.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
A new This Way Out update has been posted on our website. For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to www.thiswayout.org.
The brutal murder of a queer Native American teenager leads to a look at the spiritual nature of gender and sexuality. This Way Out, Steve Pride previews a compelling new film.
Fred Martinez Jr. was a 16-year-old high school sophomore from Cortez, Colorado. He identified as half Navajo and in the tradition of his tribe as Two-Spirit. In an earlier time, he would have been honored, but instead, in June of 2001, his body was found murdered.
I'm Lydia Nibley, the director of Two Spirits.
And what's the film about?
The film has two major storylines. One is about Fred Martinez, a young Navajo boy who was self-identified as gay and Nadle. In the Navajo tradition, the word Nadle would be applied to someone who has a masculine body and a feminine essence. So it's the story of his life, his murder, and what happened after his murder. Then the second storyline of the film goes into the Two-Spirit tradition that has been a part of many Native American cultures in North America for thousands of years. This idea that there is a variety of gender and sexual orientation, and that it's just a part of how people are made. And that, of course, applied not to all tribes, but there were many tribes in North America that had a sacred role, a special role, a particular part of society that provided either an honored place or at least a role for people who had a variety of sexual or gender expression. The phrase Two Spirits is used by the Native LGBT community to talk about itself, but it's only a simple shorthand. And the reason is they needed a phrase in English that all of us could understand and relate to simply. When in truth, the ideas behind the phrase Two-Spirit are so nuanced and so rich and so varied, with over 200 native languages and so many tribal traditions that relate to spirituality, sexuality, and gender, far from the little boxes that we put them in. The Navajo have four genders. There are tribes that have seven genders, nine genders. So how do you talk about that with 200 plus native languages and all this nuance and subtlety in relationship to sexuality and gender? You just can't.
How prevalent is that tradition today?
Unfortunately, over time, that tradition has been lost, both with the overt genocide that was practiced against Native American people, particularly those who were gender nonconforming, and also over time, of course, the Christianization, the boarding school era. There were attempts to eradicate Native culture for so long that those traditions have been almost lost in many cases. And there are traditions and there are older people who can initiate and continue that traditional knowledge, but a lot of it has been lost, unfortunately.
What inspired you to tackle this particular story?
I was drawn to the story with my husband, co-writing partner, and co-producing partner, Russell Martin, who is from that part of the world, the Four Corners region of the United States. And we had a friend who was very much involved in the aftermath of Fred's death, Kathy Renna, a gay activist who called in GLAAD to help deal at the local level with what was transpiring with the press, with the way the crime was being investigated. And their concern was that Fred be represented properly in the media, that the right kind of attention be drawn to his murder, that something good could come of it, that the local law enforcement people involved in the case would respond appropriately to Fred and his family.
What was the legal aftermath of the murder?
Part of the legal ramifications of the case were that the district attorney had at first taken the position, all crimes are hate crimes. This is not a hate crime. And yet, when the murderer was identified by friends who passed on a tip to law enforcement that he had been bragging about the crime, he had said, I bug smashed a fag. And so, of course, Kathy Renna said to the district attorney, you will not talk to the press about this not being a hate crime. This is a hate crime, and we're going to deal with it as such. So part of what was going on was the community was being sensitized to these issues through Fred's murder and how it played out in their small town. And one of the things that we were most touched by was that a police officer who had formerly given a hard time to LGBT kids or had approached these subjects from a bigoted perspective was very much changed by attending Fred's funeral, working on the case, And after all of this had transpired, he told us that he stopped kids on the street now, LGBT kids, kids he felt were at risk, to inquire whether or not they felt safe, to see if they needed help with something. So there was a redemptive quality to this in terms of how the community responded and what they learned.
What happened to the killer?
The killer of Fred Martinez was sentenced to 40 years, and now that sentence has been extended because of his violent behavior in prison. But he received the maximum penalty for the crime of which he was convicted, which was second-degree murder. He pled guilty so that he could avoid the potential of the death penalty, and so the case didn't go to trial. But obviously, it was something that was reassuring to Fred Martinez's mother that he would not be on the street in her lifetime and she wouldn't have to face him.
We had a home phone here, and he was the only one that was on that phone all the time. I mean, that was his phone. And ever since he's gone, that phone never rang again. I just got it disconnected. I just bought a cell phone, that's all I had. And anyway, he was talking to some friends, and he goes, "Mom, I'm going to the carnival. I'll be back later. I love you, Mom."
What surprised you most about Fred Martinez?
Because he was only 16 when he was killed, his life was just starting to emerge. He was just learning who he was and defining who he was going to be. So it's very sad to see a young life cut short, but we do get to know him a bit through his family and the stories that are shared about him. And he had great promise. He had the potential to be someone quite extraordinary. He was a big person. He was a big character. He was over 6 feet tall, presented himself so beautifully in the feminine that when he walked into a classroom, the teacher and the kids would think, "Who's that beautiful Navajo woman?" You know, he was quite an extraordinary person. Very loving, very concerned about others, very kind. It would have been interesting to see how his life would have evolved.
This has been a conversation with Lydia Nibley, director of Two Spirits, Sexuality, Gender, and the Murder of Fred Martinez. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts and Tina Giordano, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Dixie Trichel and John Townsend, Sherry Lunn and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is funded by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, listen to our podcasts, read This Way Out's news wrap, and subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Dade City Community Radio, Dade City, Florida, Contact FM, Hamilton, New Zealand, KUCR, Riverside, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.